This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Hello, I'm Ronnie Floyd, sitting in today for Tony Perkins. I'm the senior pastor of Cross Church in Northwest Arkansas, and I have also served just in the last couple of years until this past June as the president of the Southern Baptist Convention. It's a joy to fill in today for my friend Tony. I want to encourage you to follow Tony on Twitter at T Perkins, and also always feel free to go for the broadcast on frc.org. It would be a joy for us to have you follow us on Twitter as we write articles and release matters about our nation and other matters. And you can follow me at Ronnie Floyd. Now, today's show, we are going to talk with the Texas Governor, Greg Abbott. And we're going to be talking to Governor Abbott about the former Texas Governor, Rick Perry, who has been selected as President-elect Donald Trump's Secretary of Energy Department choice. And we'll also discuss with Governor Abbott in a moment about the Oklahoma Attorney General, Scott Pruitt, who also President-elect Trump picked for the Secretary of the Environmental Protection Agency. As well, in this nation today, Aleppo has fallen amid a horrific civil war. Retired Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari will be with us here to sort out the details. And also, we're going to talk about a record number of Somalis and how they're entering into the United States as refugees. And Jennifer Breeden with the Clarion Project will join us. And then to complete the show today, rounding out the show, we're going to be talking about the financial future of the United States of America. Interest rates have risen. We're going to talk with one of America's great business leaders, the former president of Walmart U.S., Bill Simon. He's going to be talking about the impact of these interest rates going up. We're going to also ask Mr. Simon about the issues of President-elect Trump and his choice of so many business persons in office. And so we're very grateful today that you have joined us here on the Washington Watch. And today we're about to enter into a discussion with Governor Greg Abbott, who has joined us now. And Governor Abbott, thank you for being on the Washington Watch.
It's my pleasure. Great to be with you.
Well, it's a wonderful experience to have you, Governor. I am a Texan by birth and was raised there in high school, all the way to high school, college, and then postgraduate work. But it's great to talk with you today. And as you well know, of course, President-elect Trump said that Rick Perry is going to do an amazing job in making America energy independent. And for his part, Perry says he's honored to have been chosen and deeply humbled by President-elect Trump in him. And Perry also credited him for Texas turning into the largest wind producer in the country. And of course, he's the long-serving governor in Texas until you came on the scene. And we're really grateful for you, Governor Abbott, because you're carrying on the great tradition of Texas. Also, we're going to ask Governor Abbott about his friend, Attorney General of Oklahoma, Scott Pruitt, and about his pick as President-elect Trump for the Environmental Protection Agency. Well, today, let's go right to talking with Governor Abbott. And Governor, based upon what Rick Perry did as governor of Texas, a big energy state, what does that tell us about what his vision may be for the future of America as he leads the Department of Energy in Washington?
Well, Governor Perry's vision is going to be able to execute what the priorities of President-elect Trump are. Before I became governor, I was the Attorney General in the state of Texas for 12 years. In my capacity as Attorney General, that is how I got to know now Attorney General Scott Pruitt in Oklahoma, but also as Attorney General in Texas, I served side by side with Governor Perry. And I got to see firsthand the principles and the vision and the ability to run a large state and to execute on plans that Governor Perry had. And I can tell you that Governor Perry will execute President-elect Trump's vision to make America an energy independent nation. Mm. He will do across America what he did in the state of Texas, and that is help create millions of new jobs. And he will do that while at the very same time protecting clean air and clean water, just like he did in Texas.
That's wonderful, Governor. Thank you for that testimonial about Rick Perry, whom we all have great respect for and appreciate his service to our nation. Also, Governor, as you look and think about the various cabinet picks that are taking place, and you're observing this from the state of Texas, but I'm sure that you are have been involved directly and indirectly to some degree, but what do you think about the other picks that are going on? You have any thoughts as governor looking at that, and are you encouraged with what you're seeing?
It really is amazing because you see in President-elect Trump a chief executive who is choosing other chief executives and generals and leaders, people of tremendous accomplishments. So there's one thing that stands out, and that is every single person he is choosing is a person of tremendous accomplishments. And so he's putting the very best into the cabinet who will assist the president in running the future of this country, and it promises to be a very bright future.
Governor, when I know that you mentioned that you got to know Scott Pruitt, who is the Attorney General of Oklahoma, and as you well know, the Environmental Protection Agency is a pretty challenging situation today in America. In fact, President-elect Trump said the EPA has pursued an out-of-control anti-energy agenda that has destroyed millions of jobs, and Pruitt will reverse this trend and restore the EPA's essential mission of keeping out our air and our water clean and safe. My question is, what are your thoughts about Scott Pruitt from your relationship and how you have observed him as the Attorney General of Oklahoma, and in relationship also to this new assignment that he may have the opportunity to serve his country?
Well, I know Scott Pruitt personally. I know him behind the scenes. I know him as he focuses on challenges that he faces. And together we fought side by side in challenges against the EPA. And here's what I can tell you about Scott Pruitt. He knows the law and he follows the law. And what he was committed to doing was fighting back against a lawless EPA that was refusing to abide by the law, that was making up the rules as they went along. And as a result, farmers and small businesses and ranchers were being crushed by this lawless regime under the EPA. And so it is necessary that we get someone like Scott Pruitt, who's not going to invent the law or make it up. He's going to apply the law as it is supposed to be governed by the Environmental Protection Agency, and hence restore jobs in this nation, but also restore the rule of law in this nation.
Well, the things that I hear from about him are excellent. I never had the opportunity to meet him personally, but what I hear from his pastor and many of his friends in the state of Oklahoma and others across the nation, he is obviously a man of deep conviction, very committed to law and order. He's a man where it places faith as his number one priority in his life, and he's just trying to be obedient and serve his nation as God has opened up this door. There's obviously a lot of kickback relating to that. Now, part of that is simply because the EPA is perhaps not getting someone that they're used to that would forward their agenda. But what would you tell perhaps people in the midstream, those who are more centrist, or even some evangelicals or other faiths about Scott, and that this is a great choice for America? Could you try to bring some balance to the attacks against Attorney General Scott Pruitt?
Well, as someone like myself who knows him personally behind the scenes, I can tell you he is a man of tremendous character, tremendous faith, puts deep reliance upon his faith in God to guide him in his work. But he's a person who cares about this nation and the future of this nation and the fundamental principles upon which this nation was built. And he wants to restore those principles in the branch of government that he will be operating in.
Well, Governor, just to break it down for our listeners today where we can understand in lay terms, you as the governor of Texas, tell us about, for example, when EPA would bring about some regulation, what that does to harm the energy issue or some economic issues in the country. Can you give us an example or just talk about it for a moment? Because I really want Americans today to understand the practical side of this and what your challenges have been as leaders in our nation with the EPA as it is today.
Right. Listen, there are some regulations that are issued, it could be by Washington, D.C., or by your local capital, or wherever it is that you may live, and most of those are issued because the legislature or Congress made a law that said that the agency can issue the regulation. The EPA didn't do that. What the EPA did instead is, even though there was no law by Congress authorizing them to come up with a regulation, the bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., following their own agenda, as opposed to what Congress allowed them to do, these bureaucrats decided that they would impose the types of regulations that would further a leftist agenda, and in doing so would crush the jobs of middle-class Americans. Those who are working every single day just to make a living, doing their best to follow the law, get the hammer from the federal government, crushing their dreams and crushing their ability to make a living. But that's especially true for the farmers and ranchers in this country who live off the land. Let me tell you, these farmers and ranchers, they care more about conservation and taking care of their land than any bureaucrat in Washington, D.C. And Scott Pruitt is a supporter of men and women who believe in God, who believe in the land and private property rights, but get frustrated when the federal government tramples those property rights.
So as you're out here in this process, Governor, watching all this unfold and your conversations perhaps with Attorney General Pruitt, what would you tell him at this time? If you could encourage him in any way, what would you tell him to keep the faith, to keep the agenda forward? What would you tell him as a governor and a friend of his?
Well, as his friend, I would just remind him of that all he needs to do is to be himself and stand on what got him to where he is now, and that is reliance upon God and his reliance upon the rule of law. These are core principles that Americans want to see upheld, but also understanding the plight of the middle-class American, those who have been harmed and those have been beaten down by Washington, D.C. bureaucrats who are more interested in regulating their lives as opposed to empowering their freedom. Scott Pruitt is a man who believes in the power of the liberty that is inherent in the United States Constitution, and he's going to fight for that liberty against what has been an overreaching federal government. Scott Pruitt will be part of fulfilling President Trump's vision to create more jobs and to peel back the layers of the federal government that are trying to run too much of your lives.
Well, your words are very, very encouraging, Governor Abbott, and just on behalf of the people that I know, you have a tremendous reputation. Thank you so much for your leadership of the United States. Thanks for being on Washington Watch today. And coming up next, Aleppo has fallen amid a horrific civil war, and retired Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari will join us after the break. Thank you again, Governor Abbott, for being on the program today.
Thank you so much.
Well, I hope you'll be back with us in a moment. It's an important subject that we all need to understand and something we need to talk about. And so I hope that as you are in this moment, call a friend, text a friend, let them know that we're about to talk about some of the big issues in America, ending up today with the economic challenges before us with the rising of the interest rate. Hope that you'll continue to join us here on the Washington Watch. I'm Ronnie Floyd, sitting in for Tony Perkins.
Hey, I'm Jason Gray. No matter how trapped you might feel by drug or alcohol addictions, there is a way to break free and find a new life in Jesus Christ.
Hi, I'm Cheryl. I've been using for about 42 years. I remember before thinking, what am I going to do when I'm 60, 70 years old? I was really hopeless about anything being different. Since coming to Team Challenge, I do have hope that I didn't have before. Having God, having Jesus, it'll be different. There's no way it'll be the same. He's got something good for me. I know that.
Teen Challenge helps both teens and adults find freedom from addiction to drugs and alcohol. If you or a loved one is ready to experience a new life of freedom and hope, you can call Teen Challenge toll-free at 1-855-END-ADDICTION or visit them online at teenchallengeusa.com. You are listening to American Family Radio.
Hi, this is Dan Celia from Financial Issues. You know, the charitable gift annuity concept is more important today than probably ever. It is something that you have heard me talk about for many, many years. And right now, for now, the tax code is still allowing charitable organizations to establish a charitable gift annuity so that you can be guaranteed permanent income for the rest of your life. Don't waste any time. So many of you have IRAs, 401k money. Peel off a piece of that. Establish your charitable gift annuity so that you have a portion of permanent income that you know is never going to change for the rest of your life. Would you do it today? Call AFA Foundation, 800-326-4543. Extension 345. That's 800-326-4543. Extension 345.
Hey, I'm Brant. So there's this guy named Jordan. He's a healthy guy. He's a dad of six, and he works as a guide in Alaska. And he goes to the doctor, true story. He goes to the doctor and he's diagnosed with cancer, stage four. And here's the thing. He had switched earlier from medical insurance to MediShare, where Christians share each other's medical bills. So the question for Jordan and his wife, Jenny, was, is this actually going to work?
Our medical bills exceeded $160,000. MediShare members shared all our bills.
And it was about more than just the money, too. This is a real community.
MediShare is a family, a group of people that stick with you through the hardest times of your life. I just don't know how I could have done it without MediShare.
It's so worth looking into. There's a reason this is growing so fast. So if you want to find out more, here is a number for you. 855-PSALM-23. That's 855-PSALM-23.
Good afternoon. My name is Ronnie Floyd, and I'm the senior pastor of Cross Church in Northwest Arkansas. And today I'm sitting in for Tony Perkins, who is the president of the Family Research Council and the host of the Washington Watch. What a dynamic interview we just had with Governor Abbott from the state of Texas. And now we're going to be talking about a very serious and critical issue in the Middle East. Syrian rebels are leaving the war-torn city of Aleppo after a ceasefire was reached with the government of President al-Assad. Here to help us sort out the details is retired Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari, Director of the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement. Lieutenant Colonel, thank you for joining Washington Watch today. He just returned from a trip, and so welcome here, Lieutenant Colonel Sangari.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Thank you for joining us. And let me ask you a question. Now, you just returned from that very region of the world. Tell us about what you did when you were there and talk to us about the situation there in Aleppo.
Well, part of why we went there, we needed to take a look at what's happening with the Syrian Christian refugees. And at the same time, the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement does give advice to the Syrian military forces. So as part of the Mosul clearing operations, we were on the ground looking at what's happening in the region. I will tell you, when it comes to Aleppo specifically, the reality is that the United States isn't either leading, following, or getting out of their way, which has led now to the Syrian government basically killing the Syrian rebels. And these individuals, the only option they have currently is to escape to other regions within Syria. Eventually, the Syrian government will find them and kill them too.
Well, Lieutenant Governor, let's just act for a moment like we're all here in America and we know nothing what's going on. But you're going to tell us in just a minute. You know, this is what's happening in Aleppo. Tell us the real challenges and what is actuality in as lay terms as possible for the average American to understand.
And the way I break it down for the average American, especially when I talk to high school students and college students here in the U.S., is that what happened in Syria and what has happened in Aleppo is where you have an abusive father in a house. And in this case, the United States inject themselves into that house, told the children, you need to rise up against your father. When they did so, the father turned on them, and the United States just stood back and allowed them to get wiped out. And that's exactly what's happening in the region. The only place that these individuals in Syria have to escape to now are other places within Syria. Eventually, the Assad regime and the Russians will find them and destroy them there. The only other option that they have is to escape to Turkey. Once they get to Turkey, Turkey is going to use them, as they have done previously with refugees, as nothing more than a negotiation tool in order to be able to put leverage on Europe to extract money from them. So they're going to become nothing more than another entity that's going to be used or introduced into Europe, which is going to threaten security issues for Europe, which is going to eventually threaten the security issues for us. So it would be very important the United States have a cohesive policy in that region to be able to deal with these problems.
Well, let me ask you this. When you look at the Obama administration and how they have been part of this civil war from a distance, talk to us about what was their role and versus what you feel, based off your knowledge, the role should become.
The problem with the Obama administration was, if you go back to almost 2012, in 2012, the Chinese foreign minister, Wang Yi, in a speech at the Perkin Institute, presented a new vision, and he called it a new power relations, basically, for the United States to follow. The Obama administration agreed with that vision, accepted it, which allowed the SCO of Shanghai Corporation Organization to have an extensive footprint within the region. The problem is that when Russia has an extensive footprint in Syria, China has an extensive footprint in Southeast Asia, they bring their philosophies to the table. And their philosophies are not Judeo-Christian values that we believe in and we support. Their philosophy is, if I'm going to be on the ground, I'm going to make sure that I kill my way to my final objective. And in this case, that's basically what's happening. This is the reason why people in Aleppo are dying. United States, under Obama administration, worked on economic interests only and did not understand the consequences that it was going to have on the United States in the future.
So when we get a new administration in January, what would you encourage them to do as the new administration relating to the Aleppo crisis?
I would say they cannot just negotiate with Russia on economic lines of effort, which is, you can't just look at it from an oil economic interest, because it's going to affect you in the future. Look, as an American myself, I understand that Americans feel that they have been, they've had world elites and also their leadership in the current government really have betrayed them, which led to the President Trump's election. That said, Americans are a unified nation. Should not turn their vision back from the fact that you'll have a better peaceful world order if you have a strong America. Mm-hmm. And America needs to be able to use its global influence and its power wisely when it's addressing these issues. Do not get involved in the regions, just meddle in the regions, not knowing the history of those particular areas. And if you are going to go ahead and say, I'm going to support somebody, then you just stand by him. As an example, the Christian Assyrians, the roots of Christianity, is being eradicated from the Middle East. And the United States is not even standing by the Christian Assyrians that are being eradicated in the region.
And so those of us that are Christians, and obviously most of those are connected, if they really are true followers of Christ, to a local church, what can the churches do, and what can the Christians of America do in our final moments together? Talk to me about what you would tell them what they can do.
I would say, do not make it a denominational issue. You got to go in with a unified front, right, and understand. As an example, when the House Resolution 75 was being voted on, the denominations fought so much against whose names should be put in that specific House Resolution, they no longer became about a genocide. Look, you have Assyrian Christians on the ground. They were not Assyrian before they were Christians. Support them. Support those type of forces. Support the Yazidis. You know, if you give the support to Assyrian Christians in northern Iraq and the Yazidis, then Assyrian Plain, you're looking at a 10,000-man force. Expand that to Sinjar, you're looking at a 20,000-man force. You don't need to put American troops on the ground if you just support these type of forces. However, with that said, when you come in as an American administration, you need to level the playing field and allow everybody to have a voice. You cannot just choose
your
dictator.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant Colonel, for being on the program. We're going to have to go to a break. In a moment, we're going to hear from Jennifer Breeden with the Clarion Project.
making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
We did get a little bit of economic news out here this morning. Very good news as we head into the end of the year and the end of the fourth quarter. Philadelphia Fed and the New York Fed, the Empire manufacturing number, both manufacturing numbers came in and soared, as a matter of fact. Philadelphia Fed manufacturing index went from a 9.0. So remember, anything over zero is in expansion mode. So it was already in expansion mode. It soared to 21.5. And the New York Fed manufacturing index went from a 3.0 to 7.5. Also a huge jump. We didn't see much out of core inflation, and consumer core inflation was up 0.2%. That's exactly what is expected. Last month, it was 0.1%. But CPI, consumer price index, when you include food and energy, also up 0.2%, but year over year for the last 12 months, it is up 1.7%. Now, of course, you've got to believe the food and energy prices that we're seeing. Now, this has obviously gone up. I haven't seen the gasoline price yet today, but the average gasoline price, 2.2%, not to mention we're headed into higher heating bill season. So that will impact consumers as well. Gold prices tumble after the Fed raised interest rates yesterday, obviously creating a stronger dollar. Gold tumbles to a 10-month low. Not good for those gold bugs, but good for the economy.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
Well, here today on the Washington Watch, we're talking about several major issues that are national and global issues. And today we're going to continue in that global moment here because we're going to be talking to Jennifer Breeden in a moment. And even though we know that over two decades have elapsed since the collapse of the Somali government, the United States is taking in refugees from this extremely dangerous country at the fastest pace ever. And joining us now is Jennifer Breeden. And Jennifer is the legal analyst and the Middle East expert with the Clarion Project. Jennifer, welcome to the Washington Watch.
Yes, it's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Well, we know, Jennifer, and I want you to talk about this today, that the pace of refugees from that part of the world are obviously coming at a record rate. And we know that according to what the president has said, that there's a plan established to bring in 110,000 refugees this year. In fact, to our understanding and research, the U.S. has brought in 3,000 Somalis in just 2.5 months, and that's outpacing our typical 8,000 to 10,000 that we've unprecedentedly brought in almost every year over two decades. And so this is a real challenge. We all don't quite understand what is happening in it, but we have you today, and we want you to talk to us about that. In relationship to what is happening, is this a violation of the refugee law?
Well, it's not technically a violation of the refugee laws. I mean, the refugee laws span from several different, not only UN conventions, but the U.S. The issue here is the complete and utter failure of the Obama administration to even consider or care about our national security. And so as you talked about, these numbers are just skyrocketing. And as the numbers continue to skyrocket of refugees being brought in from problematic areas with very problematic ideologies, at the same time, President Obama, his administration, has completely disintegrated our legal structure and our national security and the vetting process and how we even investigate the intelligence related to those that with extremist ties.
Well, Jennifer, 100,000 is that's a lot of people. And I'm curious, how can that happen in the time remaining in Obama's term?
Well, and what he's done is really he's done this foreign policy overhaul where he enacts laws by executive action, which technically you can do, but it's completely contrary to our constitutional laws, which dictate that Congress is in charge of a lot of this, that Congress needs to approve of this, that there needs to be votes, and Obama's just bypassed that. And not only that, he's left out the main point of the region of Somali, which in Somalia, the main group is al-Shabaab. And al-Shabaab actually pledged allegiance to ISIS, as did Boko Haram. Yet instead of informing and educating the American people about this, they just continue to talk about this as if we were different groups. We listen to stories from ISIS on the news, yet we kind of ignore al-Shabaab. But really, this is ISIS. That is ISIS. And so because of that, there's this ideology that spread globally. And now we are bringing in people with known ties to an organization that pledged allegiance to the Islamic State.
That is just simply remarkable. We're talking today with Jennifer Breeden, who is the legal analyst and Middle East expert with the Clarion Project. Jennifer, if you were sitting down in a room with President-elect Trump and his administration, and you were to talk to them about this crisis, how would you coach them to deal with this issue that is so huge, a global issue, but an issue that is now going to become a national issue and is to even our own nation?
Absolutely. And the first thing that I would do is say that President-elect Trump now has a chance to fulfill a legal obligation that that President Obama failed to do completely. That is to protect the victims of genocide. In Iraq and Syria right now, we have Christians, Yazidis, and mostly Christians that are being completely exterminated from the area. Not only that, where the United Nations gets their refugees, let's talk about the refugee situation, he's bringing in all these Somalis and people from Syria, they get them from the UN refugee camps. Actually, Christians, who are the actual victims of genocide, are not even welcome in the UN refugee camps. They're not allowed. There are minorities there. There are lots of Muslims in there. But those were the refugees that are pulled out. And so instead, we are leaving them literally to die, to fend for themselves in the middle of nowhere. And so President-elect Trump, sitting with him, if there is an obligation, if there's a UN obligation to bring in any refugees or to protect people, why don't we go and try to protect the Christians, the Yazidis, the actual victims of genocide, those with no questions to extremist ties, while we are cleaning up the vetting in our horribly crippled Department of Homeland Security?
Yes, no question about it. And obviously the challenges of international religious freedom are greater today than ever before. Jennifer, we have just about 1 minute left with you, but can President-elect Trump stop this influx long enough to vet serious extreme vetting, is what he has called it, of people coming in the United States?
Yes, he can. In fact, the current refugee laws, the United Nations Refugee Resettlement Agency, it actually takes about 2 to 3 years to vet people. We use that through the State Department to vet somebody who's going to come in, whatever. So no matter what number Obama has approved, President Trump can come in and make sure that vetting process, he can work with the State Department, his Secretary of State can work with their officials to make sure that this vetting is not only improved, but it's even elongated. And so we're looking at a couple years before we start to see any of these results. And he can certainly challenge the executive orders of Obama through constitutional law in Congress and make sure that our national security is safe before anything else.
Well, Jennifer Breeden, you have been a real help to us today, and thank you for what you are doing. She is the legal analyst and Middle East expert with the Clarion Project. Thank you again for being on the broadcast today, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Coming up in just a moment, we're going to be closing out the program today, talking with the former president of Walmart U.S., Bill Simon. We're going to be talking with him about the economy. Interest rates are going up in America. What does that mean to the average home buyer? What does it mean to the person sitting out there today in life? And so hope you'll stay tuned.
Can a Facebook post save a life? Or a tweet or an Instagram picture? At Family Research Council's 12th annual Pro-Life Con Digital Action Summit, pro-life activists from around the country will gather to explore the impact that digital media has on the culture of human life. Watch free online the morning of Friday, January 27th from 8:30 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. At this year's conference, you will hear from political leaders, bloggers, journalists, activists, and testimonies from families and individuals who choose life at the intersection of cutting-edge technology and a passion for the lives of the unborn. You'll be educated and empowered to better reach your community on platforms like Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and more. You'll be better prepared to make an impact for the pro-life movement anytime and anywhere. Also, see live coverage from the National Mall as the March for Life gets underway. Tune in on January 27th at frc.org/prolifecon. Again, visit frc.org/prolifecon for more information.
You experienced a call to ministry later in life, and now you're in a second career. You like to call it your calling. You know you need more preparation, but how? Where? Hello, I'm John Nyhoff, president of Wesley Biblical Seminary in Jackson, Mississippi, where an online Master of Divinity degree can be tailor-made for you. Small class size, individual attention, learning opportunities that fit your busy schedule. Wesley Biblical Seminary, where we equip the called. WBS.edu.
Consider serving the Lord with friendships. It's an opportunity to reach out to the needy around the world. They're now taking applications to volunteer, and they need help in the areas of mechanics, maritime, including deck, engine, and steward departments, food service, warehousing, and office. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. What's even better than the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade? The fact that this nationwide chain of department stores told Pro-Life Group Second Vote that they no longer give nor match donations to Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood, a leading participant in the Holocaust against the unborn, receives $1.3 billion in yearly revenue, with over 25% of that coming from private donations, including corporate contributions. After Second Vote's research exposed 41 companies with direct financial ties to the abortion giant last year, AT&T, Coca-Cola, Ford, and Xerox publicly distanced themselves from Planned Parenthood. Now, thankfully, we can add Macy's to this parade for life. Spread the word that these companies are taking a stand against a culture of death. Pray that others will join this parade for life. This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go. Take a look in the
Welcome back to the Washington Watch. I'm Ronnie Floyd, filling in today for Tony Perkins. And it is such a privilege today to talk to a personal friend and obviously a great business leader named Bill Simon. And Bill was the former president, or is the former president, of Walmart U.S., the largest segment of Walmart. And yesterday, all of us, if we are keenly aware that the interest rates were lifted up and hiked in the country for the first time in a while, and Federal Chairman Janet Yellen said the economy has made enough progress to justify the rate hike. She also told a news conference briefing that she expects continued moderate economic growth, and she cited ongoing improvement in the labor market and said that that should continue. Now, in a moment, when we talk to Bill Simon, we're going to be talking to him about those interest rates, what those mean for the average American, any comments he might have about that. I want to talk to him about what it's like as a business leader to sit out here and to observe President-elect Trump choosing so many business leaders, many of them colleagues of Bill's, and what he thinks about that. Also, we may even get into matters relating to the veterans because of Bill's background in the military service. And so, Bill, it is a pleasure to have you on the Washington Watch. Welcome to the broadcast today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, Bill lives in Northwest Arkansas, and he's sitting right across from the desk from me today. And, Bill, yesterday the Federal Reserve raised the interest rates for only the second time in a decade. What does this mean for the average American?
Well, inevitably, the rates were going to have to go up. If you think about it in its simplest terms, the Federal Reserve uses the money supply controlled through interest rates almost like a faucet. So when the economy needs more energy, they lower the rates and more money flows like water out of the faucet into the economy. And as the economy begins to build, the bucket begins to fill up, it becomes time for the Federal Reserve to start to close the supply of money or the supply of water if it's the faucet. And what they do, the way they do that is by raising the interest rate slightly. So what that really means for people is that everything that attached to borrowing or lending money will go up only slightly in this first instance. So if you're on a variable mortgage, your mortgage rate will eventually go up slightly. It might cost you a little bit more as a consumer to borrow money for a car. Those might sound negative. But on the other side of it, your 401k rates should begin to go up. Your savings rate should begin to go up. And eventually, we'll see income and wages start to go up. We really have had very, very flat household income in this in the U.S. for over 10 years now. And as interest rates start to go up because there's starting to be just a little bit of inflation in the economy, we'll start to see wages go up. So it has a, it's a double-edged sword, and the Fed uses the interest rates to control how much money is coming into the economy.
Well, when you were obviously involved in Walmart for so many years and then being the president of Walmart U.S., for several years, y'all had to think so much about that average American, the average American who shows up. So in the typical corporation, especially a retail-oriented corporation, how do they – do they look at things now all of a sudden? Do they adjust any strategy relating to that, or do they just kind of ride it out and see what happens?
Well, I think there'll be some adjustments to every business as interest rates start to go up. And it wasn't so much this move that the Federal Reserve made, but they sent out a very clear signal that they anticipate as many as three interest rates increases in 2017. You know, some people view that as a good sign. That means that the Federal Reserve, at least the Federal Reserve Board, believes the economy is starting to crank up at a rate that I think will make every American happy, because a robust, growing economy, 3 to 4% GDP, makes a lot of good things happen. So businesses will start to gear up. They'll start to change their thinking process. They may change how they finance their business going forward with either long-term debt or short-term debt. But by and large, it's a sign that at least the Federal Reserve believes that the economy is starting to crank up some.
Yeah, that's encouraging. Well, President-elect Trump has announced several business leaders as members of his cabinet. And you sitting out here looking at that as a business leader, I mean, you were highly significant in that and still are in all that as you look and evaluate and coach and serve in all kind of ways. How does it make you feel when you know that he is looking at some of your colleagues, some of these people you know?
That's right.
And does that encourage you, or does it say, oh, my, what are we doing?
Well, you know, there was a lot of people who were worried about the president-elect and his you know, demeanor and decision-making. But I'm telling you, as somebody who, by the way, was not a Trump guy, and we'll get to that, I guess, in a little bit if you like, the choices he's making and the processes that he's going through, I think, are fantastic. The business leaders that he selected are substantial and capable people. Andy, who he picked for the Department of Labor, I mean, he's just a phenomenal business leader. I think Rex Tillerson has demonstrated over the course of his career that he's a capable, seasoned executive and leader for one, which is fantastic. But more so, he's been in the forefront of negotiating some of the biggest, most complicated deals, albeit from a business perspective, that this country's seen, at least the business community's seen in a while. And I think those skills translate very, very well to the government. Now, it's not just the business leaders he selected, I think, have been impressive. He's picked leaders from every walk of life who are doers and action oriented, and not just you know, philosophers and thinkers. And I don't mean to be critical of the political class in this country, but you know, his selection of Governor Haley in South Carolina. Governor Haley has been very, very aggressive at building her economy in South Carolina and jobs. General Mattis, as Secretary of Defense, is a war fighter and a great American who will no doubt make this country safer. He's a doer, and she is a doer, and I'm really encouraged to see those selections, because it gives, you know, I think it gives us all this perspective that we're going to move forward, and we're going to move forward very, very quickly once the president takes office.
Yeah, and you know, the interesting thing to me is that we're talking about real leaders being appointed. We're not talking about people that are thinking theoretically. And they all are used to having a scoreboard, you know, and sometimes politicians are not always looking at the scoreboard. Sometimes they work for years and very little is able to be done because of the way the system works. But one thing that's going to happen is these men and these leaders, from military leaders to business leaders to governors, they understand the scoreboard. And obviously President-elect Trump, he understands the scoreboard in that. Now, those are the people that know you. You supported Governor Jeb Bush in the primaries. You came on early on the scene with him. You used to serve in his cabinet there in the state of Florida. And then he asked you to be the national treasurer of his campaign. And obviously, he was the guy that you believed in. Obviously, when that did not go as well as what everyone had desired and who had supported Governor Bush that we have respect for, you had a choice. I mean, you had a choice, but you never became a quote never Trumper. I mean, you very much believe in the process, and you looked at the situation and made your decision, and you're encouraged today with what you're seeing. But when you look at it, because you are somewhat unbiased when you really look at it, which there weren't a lot of people like that. But obviously, when you look at it as one of those unbiased leaders out here, how do you think that transition is going? I know you've spoken to some of the personalities, but talk to me about what you see and all that.
Well, I mean, briefly, Jeb's a terrific American and a good friend, and I think would have made a great president. The process is what drives this country. It isn't my choice or your choice. Mm-hmm. Americans get to choose who they want to be president.
That's right.
And I think they made a wise choice. They mm-hmm. determined that we needed an action-oriented guy who's ready to go. Mm-hmm. We've had policy guys, and Jeb's a terrific policy guy. We need action today, and that's what mm-hmm. I think we're seeing. And I think that's why the transition is going very, very well. For me, I watched and I listened, and after Jeb left, I made my decision, and I voted for the president-elect, and I think he's going to do a great job. And what you're seeing is a CEO's mind at work, mm-hmm. not a politician's mind at work.
Right.
And you can even sort of look at it. You know, the people who supported the president-elect politically in the campaign, who everybody said, whisper, we're going to get big jobs. I won't mention the names, but you know who they were.
Right.
They didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Because he evaluated and he appreciated their capabilities and their skills, and they're great at their roles mm-hmm. as well. But he determined that in order to run a country like you would run a company, you need the best talent that you can possibly get in mm-hmm. every role. And favors, political favors, don't cut it in a company, and they don't cut it in a country. And that's what we're seeing from the president-elect. And I'm really encouraged with the transition because he's headed in that direction.
Well, that's a dynamic observation. And obviously, it would take a man like you to be able to look at that and to talk about that. Bill, you served our nation. And many people may not be familiar with what you were a part of and all those years that you served. I want you to take a minute and talk about, with all of our listeners today, how you served our nation in the military. Talk about that.
Well, after going to college, undergraduate, I went in the United States Navy, and I went to Officer Candidate School, and I had the privilege of wearing the uniform on active duty for nearly 5 years, and then a total of 24, counting my reserve time. The things that I learned and the things that I got to do created and developed who I am today as a person.
Mm.
And I'm so happy and pleased when somebody on Veterans Day says, Bill, thank you for your service. But the real truth is I need to thank the country because wearing that uniform was the greatest privilege I ever had. I ran a big company. I led a lot of people and I've done a lot of things in my life, but I never felt better about myself, and I never felt like I was contributing more than the days that I wore that uniform. And I think once you're sworn in, you never leave.
Hmm.
And any veteran knows that we have an obligation to this country, and that oath that we took still exists today. And I think we all need to look for places where we can help the country move forward, where we can support our veterans, where we can support the members of our military, and where we have the obligation to participate in the political process and then support the people who get elected.
Well, you've had some pretty major jobs in your life, and your statement a moment ago is pretty profound, and I want to really recall that as best I can for those that are listening today. Did you hear Bill Simon, who is the former president of Walmart U.S., said out of all the jobs that he's had, nothing made him feel better about who he was and what he's done when he had the uniform of the military on his body? A man strongly committed to the future of the nation. That is a dynamic view and a dynamic commitment and conviction. Thank you, Bill, for serving our nation and how powerful that is. And as a veteran, obviously one of the big issues has been the Veterans Affairs and the Department of Veterans Affairs and all that's gone on there. And here you are. You have been the CEO of one of the largest, the largest corporation in the world. And you were in the largest segment of that, and so much depended on you. And But as you look at that, and then you look at where that department is based off of what you know, what needs to be done in the Department of Veterans Affairs?
Well, the VA, the people at the VA are honest, hardworking people who found themselves in a difficult position. And what's happened there is just unconscionable. And it isn't the fault of the people that are there, and we can blame them if we want to, but it won't solve the problem. What happened, in my view, was we didn't ramp up the VA at the same rate we ramped up the military after 10 years of war. And so as these vets came home, many of them needing help and assistance physically and mentally, and all of them needing help with the transition back into civilian life, the VA was still kind of post-Vietnam sized and funded and didn't grow and didn't develop at the rate that it needed to move forward. That's a difficult issue, but it's not a difficult issue to solve. The situation that exists at the VA can be fixed by funding, by leadership, by efficient management and operation, and by a simple one-word answer, yes. When a veteran needs something, we got to get it for them. If they need an appointment with a doctor and they can't get it at a VA hospital, they need to get it at a civilian hospital, and we have an obligation to find a way to pay for that. They're not complicated issues. They're just difficult issues, and we need to move on that. That's the only way forward, because the sacrifice that veterans make, that particularly those who give their lives and their mental and physical selves to this thing, deserve the right to come back into this country and into this economy into a healthy and prosperous way. You know, if you think about the history of our country, every single major conflict that we've had was followed by a period of prosperity. You know, after World War I, we had the roar of the 1920s. After World War II, we had the Greatest Generation. But we've had 10 years of war. And these folks that are coming back today are ready to lead us in the next economic boom period. And we, as Americans, and led through the Department of Veterans Affairs, need to sort of plow the field for them to allow them to come back to an economy and in a society that finds a way for them to deliver that next economic boom period, because that's, I think, what's going to lead us forward. Veterans can lead us forward. I think the VA plays a big part in that. They need to move from being on the defensive to being on the offensive to serve veterans.
That's great. In about 30 seconds here, I want you to tell me, because you did this at Walmart, y'all really prioritized hiring veterans and supporting them. Talk to me about that.
We made a commitment to hire every honorably discharged veteran that wanted a job. If they want a job, Walmart would have a job for them. We have pilots and we have engineers and we have, you know, people who work in factories and drive trucks. There's jobs for everybody. And we got a lot of credit for that. But the truth is, we got a lot of benefit out of it too. We got some great honorable people to work for us.
Well, Bill Simon, former president of Walmart U.S., obviously a major business financial leader in the United States and a true veteran of the military of the United States. Thank you, Bill, for being on this broadcast today, and thank you for your service to our nation. You've been very, very helpful. Thank to all of you who have watched or listened to the Washington Watch. Hope you'll tell your friends about this broadcast. Share it with them. Tell them to go on frc.org, frc.org, and they can get a copy or they can listen on to this. May the Lord bless you. Have a wonderful day. And God bless America, and God bless you.
Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.